Hey, as you sit down, make sure that you take out your Bibles and open them up to Daniel chapter 5. And you're going to want to have your outlines that say, you have been measured. You have been measured across the top of them. And you can see this is a four-page outline, which should terrify you because that's a long outline. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, how are we supposed to get through all that? And I'm kind of asking myself the same question this morning. But before I get there, I just want to... This is kind of silly. I know he would be ticked off that I'm doing this, but you guys know about 6 or 7 weeks ago, I went on a bike ride and like just did a normal human thing and threw out my back, right? I couldn't walk. I couldn't move. I couldn't tie my shoes for a week and a half. And really the only reason I believe, other than like let's just admit that God's given us great bodies that heal themselves and that kind of thing, but the guy that helped my body to heal in the right direction was Dr. Paul Newton, and he's sitting over here with his girlfriend Ruth right there, and he's my chiropractor, and he helped me out so much, and I'm delighted that he's here this morning, and I just wanted to say hi to him, and I'm sorry to embarrass you. I apologize for that. And I also want to embarrass somebody else, and where'd he go? Oh, he's walking across the back. He knew it. It's Scott Trickett's birthday, and so... He can't hear us right now, but anyway, he's like, I don't know, 49 or something like that, and so he's today's his birthday, and if you get a chance to say happy birthday to Pastor Scott, that would be awesome. Occasionally, when you come to parts of the Bible, you're going to get lost because the historical context that's behind the story is so obscure. And this morning is one of those times. And so I'm going to take some extra time this morning to give you some historical context. And for those of you that are not super nerdy and you don't even like American history, not to mention ancient Babylonian and Persian history, this might seem a little bit thick for you. So I'm going to ask you to hang in there with me because we're going to get to the story about a guy named Belshazzar. In Daniel chapter 5, it says in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. That sounds like a pretty good guy and a pretty good time right there. But in reality, that sentence means something entirely different. And I want to explain to you why that is. Babylon's King Nebuchadnezzar, that's where we've been in Daniel chapter 1 through 4, and it's number... one letter A on your outline. King Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC, or a very long time ago. And he was followed by his son, King Evil Merodach. Now, by the way, these are all Babylonian names. So when they name their children Evil Merodach, that doesn't mean what you would think it meant, okay? It doesn't mean like I expect you to be really evil and dedicated to Merodach, the god of Babylon, which was Marduk and that kind of thing. And he was followed by that son and then a couple of military officers. It kind of skipped over to some military guys that were in the kingdom at the time. And all of their reigns were very short. One of the widowed daughters of King Nebuchadnezzar actually gets married to a military officer named Nabonidus. And that military officer ends up being king of all of Babylon because of his relationship with King Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. In an ancient cuneiform, letter B, a cuneiform was that stuff that you see in museums, you know, the writing that was on clay tablets, and then they would bake those clay tablets, and they would glaze them and put them into the walls and put them into the ground and stuff like that. Those were cuneiforms, and they had different kinds of them, and I'll refer to them in the next few weeks a little bit because there's a couple that are really important, and one of them is the Nabonidus Chronicle, and I have it there. It's in the British Museum, and it's right there on your page. It's a little bit larger than what you see there, but it's named for the slashy way that they made their letters. It notes on there, kind of in a scandalous way, that Nabonidus was not committed to the things of Babylon. He was not into their gods. He was actually into a moon god called Sin. Again, not Sin like as in you understand in English. It was just the name of the god at that time period. Nabonidus disliked, letter C, the administrative aspects of being king. Who can blame him? After Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdom was gigantic, and the administrative tasks of being king were ginormous. and you had to be a figurehead in so many ways. And you know what Nabonidus really loved? He loved archaeology. In fact, in the archaeological circles, he's considered the very first archaeological digger that existed in history. He loved to go to ancient Babylonian sites and dig up out of the sand and out of the dirt these old temples, and he loved to restore them. And so he, being king, was not the fire that was in his heart. And so he did a strange thing. He moved the capital of Babylon from being in the city of Babylon 500 miles away across the Arabian desert toward Israel, just outside. In fact, we would call it the desert of Haran, just to the right down from where traditional Israel is. And he set up a kingdom there, and he set up a capital there in a place called Tema, but he was so far away, he had to leave somebody in charge of what was going on in Babylon. And so he left his eldest son, a guy named Belshazzar, who turns out to be, right, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. That's who he leaves in charge. That was his co-regent. Turn the page, letter D, top of the next page. The historical accounts of Belshazzar, and by the way, we have a lot of historical accounts. Babylon was one of the greatest ancient kingdoms in the world, as was Persia that followed it. And so we have a lot of these cuneiforms. We have a lot of historical documents, so to speak, that exist in clay, that exist on paper, that exist on ancient documents that give us a lot of insight into what was going on during those times. In fact, we have over 400 contracts that have King Nebuchadnezzar's name at the bottom of them, and give indication of some of the things that went on in the ancient world of Babylon. Well, historical accounts of Belshazzar portray him as a deviously evil leader. Nabonidus' father took the throne because of an assassination. You know who the assassin was? You know who assassinated? What turns out to be his older stepbrother, by the way. But you know who the assassin is? Yeah, it's Belshazzar. Belshazzar actually killed someone purposely to allow his father to be in control, knowing full well that his father, what? Hated this stuff. Wanted to be an archaeologist, which meant what? Belshazzar killed somebody so he could be powerful, more powerful in Babylon. A great example of this is one of the governors that worked under Nebuchadnezzar and eventually defects to the what would be historically the next king, a guy named Cyrus. One of the governors in his administration defects and tells a story that is recorded that they were out on a royal hunting trip, Belshazzar, his family, and his son killed a particularly interesting, rare, amazing beast. And his father was so filled with rage and jealousy that his son was eclipsing what he could do. He killed him on the trip and took his beast and came back with it and claimed it as his own. See, Belshazzar was known in his own kingdom as an assassin and as a murderer. Some of you take issue with the leaders that we have in this country, but you do not take issue with this, right? Like, you can have a lot of issues, but nobody's thinking that assassin and murderers, these are not the people that you would want to have as your leaders. And yet, here's Belshazzar. He's kind of crippled because his father is an absentee king. And so he's in a co-regency already. And he's known in public, inside and outside of Babylon, as being an assassin and a murderer. He was well known, and it is documented in all kinds of different places. He was well known as a wicked king. Last sentence of letter F there. A wicked king. The people in Babylon hated Belshazzar. Now when you come back and you read in that first sentence, King Belshazzar gave a great feast for all of his lords. When you read that Belshazzar was having a gigantic party and that he was drinking wine in front of all of those people, now you read it differently, don't you? Good. That's exactly the way that we should read it. Belshazzar was saturated in compromise, saturated in wickedness, and it's not surprising that's where we find him here in Daniel 5. He's actively abusing his leadership. Number 2, letter A. It says that he intentionally drank wine in front of his many guests. It may be hard to see in the text, but he was using his kingship to incite kind of a raucous party. The wording used depicts a drunken scene. The word for drank and drink in these verses refers to drinking in an ongoing, not stopping, going to keep going until we're all sloshed kind of manner. And so the scene is one in which Belshazzar's judgment seems to be increasingly impaired. He starts out drinking, and by the time you get a couple of verses later, he's making crazy decisions even for himself. He shows a profound lack of decorum, an overt defiance of God, by ordering Israel's golden vessels. These were the goblets that were used in temple worship back in Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar had taken them and put them in the treasury of Babylon some 80 years before. Probably 70 years before. And they were brought over to Babylon and put into their treasury. We find out later in the story that Belshazzar did this on purpose. He wasn't just grabbing random items out of the treasury because they'd run out of cups. It was purposely done. He chose to do it. There was a reason that he did it. He was purposely kind of looking at God and giving him the, you know, the your number one sign. He was purposely blaspheming the name of God. And again, reading through this as we take a look at it, it says that they brought in the golden vessels. I'm in verse 3 of chapter 5, by the way. That had been taken out of the temple and the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. That might be offensive, but it doesn't seem like it's all that big of a deal, right? They drank wine and praised the gods. Here we go. Verse 4, and this is what he was leading from verse 1. They praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. So they're participating in idolatry with these elements, which again, probably does not strike us as being the biggest of deals. But it was the purpose, it was the drive, it was the intent that was behind all of it. He did not do this ignorantly, in other words. Not that it would excuse the offense, but I want you to catch here that Belshazzar was a wicked guy, and he meant this for a reason. I note down in letter D, even with that, why? Why would he do it? Why would Belshazzar purposely challenge God? That just seems stupid. Even if he doesn't believe that the God of the Hebrews was all that big of a deal, why in the world would he do it? We can't know all the reasons because obviously this chapter is not written by Belshazzar. You might have noticed at the end of the chapter, if you read ahead, that he's about to die. And so we don't get a whole lot of more information from him on the subject. But what we can know are some of the things that were going on historically, background in this story, and some of the things that we see that he's attempting to do. And so I'm going to detail those in letter E and the ones that go forward from there. According to that same Nabonidus Chronicle on the front of your outline, Babylon had suffered a terrible defeat at the hands of the Persian army just days before this. Just days before this party happens, they've suffered a terrible, terrible defeat. Nabonidus had fled. His father, the king, the one that was the primary regent in Babylon, the one that was supposed to be in charge and had set up his kingdom elsewhere, had come to fight this battle and had gotten just had gotten his butt kicked. And so he flees, and he doesn't come to hide in Babylon. He flees out into the desert and runs away. He abandoned ship. He fled. And he was nowhere to be found. Belshazzar saw this not as a surprise, but he saw it as an opportunity, right? This is an opportunity for me to establish myself as king. So Belshazzar's party was meant to instill confidence. It was meant to build morale. It was meant to say, the Persian army's at our doorstep, but we're going to be okay. It was to show the power that he had in the face of an army that was coming, and well, you probably would expect him to. Like the United States of America, the city of Babylon and the kingdom of Babylon was the strongest in the ancient world. The people would have known about Nabonidus' defeat, but since Babylon was such a heavily fortified city, it actually says in numerous documents that they had enough food storage inside of the city, and the Euphrates River ran right through the middle of the city, that they had food for years. They could They could close their gates and still supply for everybody inside of the city for years to come. They had water resources and everything. They had great confidence in Babylon's defense. Further, King Belshazzar and his people would have known about the extraordinary prophecy of Isaiah. See, they were all those Hebrew exiles had come, and everybody knew about Isaiah's prophecy. You may not even remember what it says, but 150 years before this time period, Isaiah had prophesied that God's people would be in captivity, and that they would be in captivity to Babylon. And it specifically says at the end of Isaiah chapter 44, in the beginning of Isaiah chapter 45, it specifically names Cyrus as being the one that would come and free the Israelites from their captivity. 150 years before this happens. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus, and now Belshazzar, they all know this stuff. And so what's Belshazzar doing at this party? He's standing up and he's like, I'm fully aware of what this other god said. We're going to stand up to him. Bring me his vessels. Bring me his vessels. He has no authority over us. Finally, letter H. Belshazzar was King Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, but he also served in Nebuchadnezzar's government. He was old enough to have been a high-ranking official, and he was a high-ranking official in the years that followed. He was there to see the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Do you remember what happened at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign? Daniel chapter 4. Remember how God humiliated Nebuchadnezzar during those years? He hadn't just heard this story. He had seen this story. Now let's seal this all up. Letter I is extra obnoxiously long, and it's just to kind of grab hold of what's going on. King Belshazzar was measuring himself against a Persian army that was coming up on his doorstep. He was measuring himself against the loyalty of his own subjects. Would they be loyal to me, even though they know I'm a murderer, an assassin, and they don't like me? He was measuring himself against his own father, who had abandoned Babylon's gods, abdicated the throne to him. He had left his people behind, and now he was completely absentee for his son. He'd basically abandoned ship and left him in charge. He's measuring himself against haunting predictions of destruction by his enemies. He was measuring himself against the legacy of his grandfather, the greatest king in Babylonian history. And most of all, against that mysterious God. It says in the old documents of Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar had gone crazy, that he had gone through a temporary loss of his mind. And Belshazzar had seen all of that happen. And so he's standing up to all of these things. He's measuring himself. This is a moment for him. We can almost climb into his brain, can't we? Letter J. You can almost feel how it comes together in his head. He's drinking wine. He's seeing all this go on around him. And he thinks to himself, this is my moment. If I am ever going to be king, if I am ever going to take control, if I am ever going to have Babylon, these are the things that I need to stand up against. This is the kind of confidence I need to show. Bring me those golden vessels. We are going to do this thing. We are not just going to have authority and have those people in exile. We're going to take the Jews and we'll actively mock this God that took out my grandfather. And I will be known as more powerful than all of them. And quite suddenly, in the middle of this, while he's drinking the wine and praising the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, in verse 4, it says immediately, shockingly, just out of the blue, fingers, the disembodied fingers of a human hand, appear and write on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. By the way, this ancient Babylonian palace, the main area where Babylon operated from was dug up in the late 1800s, 1898 to 1899. And they note that the walls that are inside of the primary temple area are covered in white gypsum, a white plaster of gypsum, one that if if a finger were to drag across the wall, it would look like the dirty fingers of a child inside of your home, right? It would definitely leave a mark. And so that's the context. The fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. In other words, right in a place where everybody could see it. The king saw the hand as it wrote, and his color changed. His thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. And whose wouldn't? If a hand appeared up on the wall and started writing, who in here would not be completely freaked out by the experience? All of us would be undone by something like that. When God reaches into the fishbowl that is humankind and does anything, what does it do to the fish? They freak out. And this is a great example of that. God's hand reaches in and writes on the wall. Suddenly, Belshazzar is sobered up. It causes him nearly to pass out. He is dizzy with panic. It says that he screams for his advisors. The advisors could certainly read the words on the wall. They were written in Aramaic, which was the common language of the time. But they just made no sense. They just, four words on a wall, what does that mean? Why is that significant? They could read what it said, but they didn't know what it meant. And it must mean something significant because a hand appeared out of nowhere and wrote it there, and the king knows what he's rolling the dice on. And he knows that this is bad. He calls all the advisors together. And they can read the words, but they don't have any idea what they mean. And so it says that the queen mother shows up. Letter C of number 3. The queen mother comes and tells Belshazzar about Daniel. Daniel had been around. Now, you got to remember, it's been 20 years, actually just over 20 years since Nebuchadnezzar has died. And in the last several years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Daniel was not actively in the court because Nebuchadnezzar was not around. And so it's been probably 30 years since Daniel has been a significant figure in the court of Babylon. And so as Belshazzar comes in, he knows of his grandfather, he knows of his father, but Daniel is an old legend. He's ancient history. And so the queen mother, perhaps the daughter, perhaps even the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, comes into the court, and it says in verses 10 through 12 that she tells Belshazzar, calm down. There's somebody that can interpret this. Would you quit freaking out, essentially? There's a guy named Daniel, and in Daniel is the Spirit of God. In Daniel is a spirit that is unlike anybody else's, and at one time he was in charge of all of the advisors. At one time he oversaw everybody under your grandfather's, and he's called father in here, the predecessor, under your father's rule, Nebuchadnezzar. You should call on Daniel because he had fame and the Spirit of God was in him. Number 4, letter A, back sheet on your outlines. After welcoming Daniel into the palace, which he does in verse 13, he welcomes him in and he says, and by the way, Daniel's probably close to 80 years old, just to give you a little bit of context, right? This is not young Daniel that we find in Daniel chapter 1, who's probably 14, 15 years old. He is now 80-year-old Daniel. And so what does Belshazzar do? He says, hey, Daniel, I've heard that you're an awesome guy, that you know incredible things, and that you can interpret mysteries, and I'd like you to interpret this mystery, and if you do, I will make you third ruler in the kingdom. He doesn't know where his father is. That's first ruler. He's the second ruler. So he's essentially saying you get to be the vice president, right? You get to be the third ruler. And Daniel, what does Daniel say? Awesome. I'm hopeful for that. No, not exactly. That's not exactly his response. Daniel comes in, and after he offers him the purple robe, the gold chain, and third ruler in the kingdom, it says in verse 17, Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, even though I don't care about the stuff you want to give me, I'm going to go ahead and interpret this for you. I'll read the writing of the king, and I will make known to him the interpretation. This was the call of Daniel's life. This is why God gifted him way back in chapter 1. I'm gifting you so that you will show my glory to the Babylonians. I want to make sure like that it was one of the gifts that he gave to him. And he gave it to him for moments just like these. And we see these moments as we progress our way through the book of Daniel. Daniel has none of the gifts, letter C of number 4. And I just want to note, perhaps it's because God has already given him a prophecy, and we'll talk about these in future weeks. Under Belshazzar, Daniel begins to have these, what I would call apocalyptic visions of the future. They're wild and crazy, and he writes and describes them in very, very vivid language. And we'll talk about them in future weeks. But he has these visions, and one of those visions predicts Babylon's demise to the Persians. Like, he already knows that the army that is coming, he already knows the story about Nabonidus, all these things that are happening. He knows that it spells the end of Belshazzar's kingdom. He doesn't know when it's going to happen, he just knows that it's going to happen. And so when Belshazzar offers him, hey, I'm going to make you third in the kingdom, what is Daniel think? Who cares? I already know you're going down. I already know you're going to die. That means nothing to me. Perhaps that's the reason. Perhaps he just knows what Isaiah said 150 years earlier, that Cyrus, the guy that's coming, is going to take over the Babylonians. We don't know exactly why he acts this way. Perhaps he just knows the reputation of Belshazzar. He knows that he is a particularly evil guy. But we do know this. Daniel treats Belshazzar fairly rudely for a king. He's got basically no time for him. He he's really an angry 80-year-old guy in this chapter. He's kind of like, get off my lawn kind of thing, right? He's not happy. It's like they woke him up and he's like, dang! Marches in there and says, I don't care about what you want to give me, but I'll read the writing for you anyway. I don't know if he glanced over at it and saw what it meant and understood what God was saying and was like, oh, this will be great. And just is ready to lay it on him. We're not totally sure, but he's not real kind about the whole thing. He acts differently. He refers to the history of Nebuchadnezzar and his relationship with Nebuchadnezzar and his friendship with Nebuchadnezzar. He relays that back fondly. But he takes this moment to kind of hammer on his grandson. He takes this moment to kind of go, you came from something great where God revealed himself to you. And Belshazzar, you've kind of spit on. He takes this moment to take Belshazzar to task. Daniel fearlessly and unflinchingly proclaims the greatness of God. He calls God the Most High God. It's emphasized in the text. He says, God is the Most High God above all others. And you need to get this clear, Belshazzar. That's who wrote on your wall. He fearlessly takes the king to task. I'm on number 4, letter E. Condemning his arrogance, idolatry, and blasphemy against God. And he points out to him in verses 21 and 22. He's talking about what God did to Nebuchadnezzar. He said, he's talking to Belshazzar and he says, Nebuchadnezzar was driven from among the children of mankind. His mind was made like that of a beast. His dwelling with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God, the same Most High God that I referred to earlier, rules the kingdom of mankind and sets it over whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew everything. This was not lost on you. You knew all this stuff. You saw it happen. And yet, this is what you've chosen to do. Verse 23, you've lifted yourself up against God. The vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. The things that you do not see, hear, or know, but the God in whose hand is your very breath, and in whose hands are all your ways, you have not honored him. It's from the presence of this God that the hand came. That's where the writing came from. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. I wrote those words in Hebrew. In Aramaic, they're a little bit sharper, and they're a little bit more jotty and that kind of thing. And I couldn't find a font, honestly, to get them there. But I wanted you to see what those looked like in a Semitic language. If you just imagine them without quite so much flair and curl to them, that's probably what it looked like on the wall. They're very simple words, actually. Mene was a measure. In fact, in the New Testament, they take an Aramaic word, mene, and we know it as mina. Some of you will remember the story of the minas in the New Testament. It's just a measure of something, a measure of wheat, a measure of money. It was a weight, actually, that measured something. Tekel was, which, by the way, is where we get the word shekel from in Hebrew. Okay, again, tekel is simply a weighing process, like weighing gold. And parson, or peres, in verse 28, which is the singular, parson is in the plural, means to divide something. It's to divide the measure, like taking a bag of bread and dividing it into two parts, cutting something in half, taking what you have, your mina or your shekel, and you break it apart. That would be your peres. You're taking it and breaking it into two different pieces. And so the concept was very, very simple. When they looked at it, they just were like, okay, we don't get it, though. We've got two menes, one tekel, and one peres. What does that even mean? We can read it, but it doesn't make any sense. And so he tells them in verse 26, mene, God has numbered. It's repeated twice, meaning God has measured it, and God has measured it carefully. He has numbered the days of your kingdom. He has taken the days of your kingdom, and he has brought them right down to the very, very day, and he has measured them carefully. Tekel, you, Belshazzar, have been weighed. You have been weighed, and you have been found wanting. In other words, you've been weighed, and you've come up light. God has weighed who you are and what you are about, and you do not measure up. That is a stiff statement. And Perez, your kingdom, that which has been numbered, is now going to be divided and is going to be given to the Medes and the Persians. This is a repetition of what Isaiah had said 150 years earlier. It's a repetition of a prophecy that he's going to make two chapters later that happens right before this. It's what Daniel already knew. This kingdom will fall. And it is destined to be divided. It is destined to be broken apart. And we've seen that prophesied all through the book, right? This has been repeated again and again and again. Daniel bluntly, I'm in number 5, letter C, shares God's judgment against Babylon and King Belshazzar. You've been carefully measured. You've been weighed. God has found that you do not measure up, that you are light, and the kingdom is to be divided. So what does Belshazzar respond with? He makes Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom. Fantastic, right? Except for the verse that comes next. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. So you're vice president for like 3 or 4 hours. And now in marches Darius, the Mede, who will receive the kingdom. It's prophesied back in Isaiah that this is going to happen, that Darius, this kingdom is going to provide freedom for the Israelites. You know what it says right before his name is mentioned? It says that he's going to dry up the rivers of Babylon. You know how they invaded? They dammed off the Euphrates River, the water source that ran right through the middle of Babylon. If you remember the map that I gave you of Babylon, and it shows how the Euphrates went right through the middle of it, they dammed it up and their army invaded through the riverbed and literally walked in. They had all the gates guarded, it said, and they came in undefended through the waterways of the Euphrates. They cut the water level down slowly and then came flowing straight in right where that waterway is and invaded Babylon. And you know what it says that the people did? They celebrated the invading army because they hated Belshazzar so much. They welcomed the invading army with open arms. That's how much they hated the leadership that Belshazzar provided them. Those things are all documented historically. Where do you come at the end of this story? What are you left with at the end of the story? Why is this story in Scripture? Is it just to communicate the how God preserved His people? I think there are a couple of things that I would walk away with, and the worship team is about to come back, and we're going to take a little time to respond. And sometimes it's hard to respond. You feel like, wow, I just got like this gigantic history lesson. But I don't want you to miss these couple of things. First off, Belshazzar could have responded to the things that God had revealed in his life, but he chose to go and do things his own way. And I would ask you, is that a good description of your life? Is it a description of where you and your family and your legacy are at? Has God revealed himself to you? Because remember, there's only five chapters, and this covers about 70 years. Remember, I said this last week. God doesn't make himself obvious all the time. It's not like this constant thing that goes on. But there are moments in our lives where we know for sure what we should do, and we often, like Belshazzar, ignore them and do things our own way because it's just more control for us. Putting God in control of our lives, that's craziness, right? It's insanity. Living for Christ, for real, in this world? I would ask you, if God came to you today and He measured and weighed your life, what would be the legacy that would flow out of it? What would be the legacy of your life? Because I think all of us, and this is the second thing I walk away with, I think all of us think of this moment that Pastor Scott spoke of earlier, that every human being will stand before God and we will be weighed and measured. In that moment, what will be the measure of your life? Because I got to tell you, I don't measure up. I'm a screw up. I not only sin, but I just do stupid things sometimes. Sometimes because I'm stupid, but other times just because I'm human. I sympathize with that. I look at Belshazzar's life and I don't see somebody that's so offensive to me. I just see somebody I get. I see a son who didn't have a father. And I see the decisions, the desperate decisions that he makes because of it. I look at Belshazzar and I don't think that guy was an idiot. I think he was holding on for dear life. And I got to tell you, as the father of two teenage girls and, you know, the husband of one wife, because he had concubines. I mean, I don't even know what kind of insanity that is, but, you know, like, yeah, I just have one, and I'm, I got to tell you, I don't feel like I belong half the time. I don't feel like I know what in the hey-ho is going on. And if you're anything like me, I mean, you can put on a good face, but let's face it, we're constantly in the fog, aren't we? We know a lot about where we've been and very little about where we're headed. Like, I get Belshazzar. In this story, that's my guy. I see these words written about my life that I've been weighing, that I've been measuring, that I just don't measure up. which is why it makes so much sense that just some years after this exile, that Jesus Christ would come and he would say, put your faith and trust in me. That when Jesus is measured, when Jesus is weighed, he measures up. And it's only through a relationship with him. From the beginning of Genesis to the end of Revelation and everything that fits in between, it's only in a relationship with Jesus Christ that we can be weighed and measured according to something that counts to God. And I would throw out to you this morning, if this is your life that's in these pages, like it's my life in these pages, could I appeal to you to trust and to throw everything on the mercy of Jesus? It wasn't up there long this morning, but right before our very first song, there were some verses that were on the screen. And if you're quick, you can throw them up there. But they were from Matthew chapter 11. And Jesus Christ said, all things have been handed over to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. No one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal himself. Jesus Christ has actively revealed himself to you. Through the words of Scripture, through the people of God, he has chosen to reveal himself to you. And he says, work hard so that you can meet my standards. Is that what he says? No, that's not ever what God says. What does he say? Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden or carry a heavy burden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke. We would picture it like a backpack or something that is heavy that is laid upon us. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. I am gentle and I am lowly or kind in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke or my burden is easy, my burden is light. That's the kind of God we serve. The one that measures you. The one that weighs you. And he finds you to be short. He finds you to be light. He finds you to not measure up. And so he provides. He doesn't resent that. He doesn't hold that. He just says, here is the greatest of provisions for you. This is grace. The undeserved love and goodness of God. And I would ask you this morning, where do you fall? Because Belshazzar is a cautionary tale. And Daniel steps in and says, it was right there. Why did you not take hold of it? God, we come to you this morning, and as we respond, as the worship team helps us to respond in music, as we respond in our giving, as we respond as people, God, I pray that you would call many people that are here this morning to give up on our ways of figuring stuff out, to give up on our ways of finding confidence and power and doing things in ways that make sense to us, and that, God, we would give ourselves up to you. It's right there before us, and I pray that we would embrace it, that we would be men and women that take on the yoke of Jesus instead of the yoke of this world. God, I pray that you would help us to respond right now, that we would not be dull, but that we would be sharp in the way that we respond, and that we would trust and submit all of our life to you. God, begin in us something that will leave a legacy that, when divided, multiplies. When it moves forward in history, God, it makes a difference for your kingdom. We thank you for all that you've given us in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Ushers, come on forward and let's stand and respond this morning.